I wanted to start by talking about the title of the book, which seems like a good place to start.
Sure.
And let me take it in two parts, one for each word. I was thinking about the word elegy.
Mm-hmm.
And an elegy is usually something that's written for something that is bygone or dead or in the past. Why that word specifically?
Yeah, so first I wanted it to reference my dead grandparents, so it has a very specific meaning in that sense, and that's who I dedicate the book to. And obviously, if you've read the book, you know that's a very important part of my life. The other meaning of elegy, which I think of less as something, a lament for something bygone, and just a sort of sad tribute, I think that captures what I'm doing more generally, which is taking a broader look at a community that has struggled quite a bit these days.
Now let's look at the other word, hillbilly. There's been a lot of talk since the beginning of the Obama administration till now about reclaiming words. This is a word that clearly has been pejorative for most of its time in the English language. How do you see that you are using it?
Yeah, well, that's another word I think that has multiple meanings. So as my grandma once told me, hillbilly is a word that we can use among ourselves within our family. But when an outsider uses it, you really have to get pretty upset and maybe punch him in the nose. And that's how I sort of think of it. It's a term that I've heard folks in my family use lovingly for a long time, but it's also a term I've heard outsiders use in a very pejorative way. So I sort of think of it as having both meanings, and both are represented in the book.
And it turns out that the word Hoosier is very similar. I have colleagues who are from the St. Louis area who have used the word Hoosier not to refer to generically anybody who's from Indiana, but somebody who might have similar characteristics to what somebody who's not from Appalachia would use the word hillbilly for.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually remember somebody calling a driver with an Indiana license plate Hoosier in a very pejorative way when I was a kid. So
there's been a lot of talk since the election about how people should read your book to begin to understand how the election that just happened. And I'm curious how that affects you. I mean, do people come up to you and think of you as, for better or for worse, some sort of oracle of Trump?
Well, some people certainly do think that. I've always found it a little bit weird. I've always been a little bit uncomfortable with the idea that I'm some sort of oracle or Trump whisperer or whatever the word may be. I do think the book is an important insight into a community that did go very heavily for Donald Trump, and I think a lot of ways really turned the election for Donald Trump. But it's always struck me as a little bit, in some ways, offensive in and of itself to assume that an election that was driven by, you know, 62, 65 million people, whatever the total number was of voters that Trump got, to try to reduce it into a single book, because obviously that many people necessarily has to be more complicated.
Do you think that all of this talk about white working class voters, and sometimes it's been said uneducated, undereducated white voters, and clearly aiming these ideas at the Rust Belt, at Appalachia, places like that, is that an unnecessary black mark that's been placed on these people who, I mean, are hardworking people just like the rest of us?
Yeah, I don't know that I think it's unnecessary. It's definitely deployed in a way that I occasionally think is offensive, right? So oftentimes I see the way that people talk about Trump voters, the lower educated, as sort of a dog whistle for they're a bunch of idiots. That's what people really mean. So I am a little on guard whenever I hear people sort of describe all of Trump's voters as uneducated. And, you know, if you read the book, you know that I don't necessarily see a connection between education and intelligence. My grandma didn't graduate from high school. What was one of the smartest people that I knew. At the same time, I do think that it's a useful way of framing the issue, because often those who don't go to college are those with the worst job prospects over the past two or three decades. And unfortunately, those are the folks who feel left behind, in many cases have been left behind, and consequently were really looking to shake things up this cycle.
How does your family see you? I mean, you talk a little bit about the fact that it's somewhat outside the norm for someone who came up with your upbringing to then go to Yale Law School.
Sure.
How does your family see you? Do they see you as, you know, the college boy, or do they welcome you back at the family reunion just like everybody else?
Yeah, I think they welcome me back. I don't think that they ever will see me as the college boy. They'll see me as the goofy little kid that they knew growing up. And that's of course, a good thing. I do think that my family, generally speaking, is very proud of me, and that feeling that I have that sometimes when you go from you know, a lower class environment to an Ivy League school, you always feel like a bit of an outsider, I think. But I've never felt like too much of an outsider among my own family. I think that's a more broader cultural phenomenon.
With respect to taking a look at what the people in your book can teach us about what is now the dominant narrative in this country, a lot of it comes back to economic issues. A lot of it comes back to talk about jobs. And, of course, you've got a number of heritage industries, for instance, the coal industry in Appalachia. And you've got people who have worked there, people who have worked there for their families for generations.
Sure.
And I'm curious what you think those voters actually want going forward with respect to their economic prospects. Is it that they want to keep doing what they've been doing? Is it that they want to be thought of in a different way? From your research, what do you think the answer is?
Well, I think that it's all of the above, and I've always resisted a little bit the idea that we should understand the Trump phenomenon in primarily economic terms. I've always thought of it less as a purely economic thing and more as a broader social thing. So it's not just that you can't find good jobs. It's also that your communities look a lot different, meaning, you know, you walk down Main Street and half the businesses are closed. People are dying of opioid overdoses. People are really struggling in their family life. The incarceration rates among working class white Americans is going up. So my sense is that there's just a broad sense of decline, that things aren't going well. And folks really want that to be different, not just in the economic way, but in every other way, too. Now, obviously, there's a strong connection between that sense of social decline and jobs. And so I do think the message of Trump that resonated the most was this promise that we're going to bring jobs. And I don't think it was a specific resonance. It wasn't, we're going to bring back this exact type of job. It was just more the feeling that when you graduate from high school, or if you were recently laid off, you're going to go be able to apply for something that's there. And so that's the sense that's the metric by which I think Trump will ultimately be judged, is generally, do things start to get better? Do some semblance of jobs come back? I happen to think that's a very complicated and difficult question. It implicates technology and automation, the way that we educate a modern workforce. So I don't think that there's a simple, let's bring the coal or steel jobs back. But I also think that if folks are employed in next generation jobs with dignified work and good wages, that they're not going to be angry that Trump didn't bring back the steel jobs.
Do you think, though, that there were a significant number of people who did not hear that nuance for one reason or another, and did hear, I'm going to bring the old coal jobs or the old steel jobs back, and they're hearing what they want to rather than what is actually likely?
I'm sure there was some element of that, but the sense that I get is that their reaction to Trump was much more broad. It was not, here's a specific policy that Trump's promising that I'm going to really get behind. It's a narrative of decline that, one, really resonated with them, and then just generally a sense that we're going to bring this thing back. We're going to make America great again, as the famous slogan goes. So I never got the sense that folks were saying, or sort of picking a really small part of Trump's stump speech and saying that's what matters the most. I got the sense that it was a much more general sense of decline and eventually reversal of decline.
It strikes me that your book is a lot about the concept of adaptation. You mentioned your grandmother having this great emotional intelligence, this great worldliness, despite not graduating from high school. We talk about you going off to Yale. We talk about these workers having to decide if the industries that they thought they were going into are going to be there in time for them to retire. Did you think about that concept of all of these different sorts of adaptations as you were writing the book?
Well, I definitely did, and I think that's one of the real themes, like you said, running through the book. There's this constant sense of changing into a new environment. And that's something that's never going to stop happening, right? So I do resist this idea that we can sort of freeze a particular moment in time, the 1970s, the 1990s, or what have you. At the same time, there is this sense that people have nowadays that maybe that adaptation is happening at a much faster pace than it was 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. And so I think that's an important, though maybe underexplored phenomenon and sort of what's going on in America. It's not just that the world is changing, it's that it's changing on a timescale that's 2, 3, 5 years as opposed to 10, 20, 30 years.
Do you find that the companies that are employing a lot of the people, these working white voters, are changing faster than the towns, the social norms, et cetera? Has the pace of business, the pace of communication, commerce, trade, which was so talked about in the election, outstripped the speed at which some of these communities want to or are able to adapt?
Well, that's maybe true. I think the way that that's most true, obviously, is that the skills required to work in some of these industries is changing very rapidly, right? So if you think about what it meant to work on a manufacturing assembly line in an automobile plant in the 1920s, it was different, but not that much different from what the same job required in the 1950s. But I think that both what skills are required relative to the 1990s, maybe that change has been a lot more rapid, and also more importantly, just the way that these sort of jobs are organized in a certain way, right? So there was a GM plant that closed, I believe, in the 1990s, maybe in the early 2000s. It's not that those jobs completely disappeared, or it's not that the productivity represented by those jobs disappeared. It's that they were, you know, replaced by some things, automation, robots, and so forth. But they also just went to other location. So there is definitely a sense in which this is happening very rapidly. But I resist the idea to say that it's sort of happening too rapidly for people to adapt. I just don't think that we've been thinking about how to maybe help them adapt.
We talk a lot about the idea of job retraining, but it seems to me that there's some amount of people retraining that this election became about, because it became about, do you want to learn a new way of things, or do you want to keep the old way? And that's probably too much of a reductionist way to look at the election. But it seems to me that you've got people who need some sort of retraining to look at the way that millennials, for instance, see the world versus the way that our grandparents see the world, because they're very different things. And if you buy into that concept, then you will need retraining to understand modern economics, modern trade, the way businesses think about their workers. You mentioned automation a minute ago. Do you think that people need to buy into the idea of constantly retraining ourselves, constantly thinking about making ourselves more high tech in the way we operate, just regardless of your political stripe?
That's maybe a fair point, but I don't know that I think that folks have not bought into the idea that we need to constantly be retraining. I mean, I mentioned earlier that it strikes me that the speed of change is maybe a little bit quicker than it used to be, but there's always been a requirement for sort of reinvention and change in the American workforce. And part of the impression that I get when I look at the modern American labor force is that folks feel like they've bought into the training, they bought into the re-education, but maybe things just haven't quite worked out as promised. You know, it's not like people, for example, are resistant to go and get a college degree. The number of people who have spent at least some time in a college environment of some sort has just skyrocketed. But there is also a real sense that the payoffs of a college degree maybe aren't quite as great as they used to be. The debt necessary to get a college degree isn't quite as great as it used to be. So while I do think that it's necessary for us to keep our focus on the fact that we do need to retrain, we do need to adapt to the modern workforce, I also think it's important to recognize the ways in which some of the ways that people have retrained themselves, some of the ways that people have tried to adapt to the modern workforce hasn't necessarily worked out. So there's a disconnect between what people expect to be happening, in some ways what was promised would happen, and what actually is happening.
So along those lines, Donald Trump during the campaign spends a lot of time talking about bringing jobs back to America. Let's say he accomplishes that. Will the jobs that are brought back be jobs that people in Appalachia could take?
Well, in some cases, yes, and in some cases, no, right? This goes back to the retraining question. We know that there is at least some trend in manufacturers reshoring American jobs, so taking productivity that's being done in China, India, Singapore, so forth, and bringing it back to the United States. But we also know that when they come back, one, the jobs are a little bit different, right? They require a certain facility with robotics and automation and technology and so forth. And two, there just aren't as many of them in a pure labor sense, right? We're getting more productivity out of the average manufacturing hour than we used to, that's a good thing. The bad side of it is that we need fewer workers to achieve that same level of productivity. So I'm a firm believer that if you look at the American labor market, you see not just jobs being destroyed, but new and different jobs coming online to replace them. But if people aren't prepared to take them, then what they see is a lot of job postings, a certain frustration that they are not able to take those job postings, and of course, the American economy suffers in the process.
There's kind of a classist argument that's been made. Some people have said, look, these people made a bad decision to go into a coal mine, and that's why they have black lung. But I wonder if the opposite is also possibly true simultaneously, to where you talk a lot about the cycles of bad things that happen to working white voters, whether it be disease, addiction, abuse, alcoholism, all sorts of stuff that keeps people at a level to where they can't advance as fast as they might like to. So it seems to me the question becomes, did they make a bad choice, or did they make the only choice in some cases that they could, because some of these communities are so based around one industry like the coal industry? What's your thought on that?
Well, first I should say I do think there's a strong element of personal responsibility. That's a theme that exists in my book, and I don't want to discount this. I certainly think that many bad things have happened to the white lower-income voters, the white working class, and so forth. But I also do think that there's something to be said for recognizing the ways in which you can still exercise some control over your life. And indeed, I push back against this idea that we're entirely victims, right? I like to think of this as much more complicated. In some cases, we're victims. In some cases, we're not. And that's an important thing to keep in mind. You know, to this question of whether folks made a bad decision going into the coal mines, you know, I think that's a really tough argument to make. One, because, you know, a lot of people didn't necessarily recognize the risks. Second of all, it may have been the only choice that was available to them. And if you give someone a choice between letting their son and daughter starve or going and doing a really hard job, I think it's admirable that they chose go and do a really hard job. But I do think that it speaks to a certain failure to, you know, prepare for the next generation of things to do. You grow up in some of these areas. My grandpa talked about this when he was growing up in the 30s and 40s in eastern Kentucky, and people still talk about it today, where they sort of assume that these coal jobs are going to be there, or in southern Ohio, they assume that these steel jobs are going to be there. I think that's a failure not just of understanding the way that the world is changing. It's also a failure of educators, of community institutions to actually educate people for the next generation of what's happening.
Let me end by asking you to look forward a little bit. Do you think we're at a place where America is getting further apart, where you've got the Eastern coastal society thinking less and less about the people in Middle America? Or do you think that the election that's just happened and the effect that white working class voters had on it have the ability to actually make the power centers on the coasts think a little bit differently about how we are all one electorate, and perhaps over some period of time draw us closer to a better understanding of one another regardless of our background?
Well, I think many people are trying, and I think both the so-called coastal elites but also people in the middle of the country, there are a lot of good conversations that are happening about how we need to better understand each other. You know, the Trump voter is saying, I need to better understand the Hillary voter. The Hillary voter is saying the same thing about the Trump voter. But I am a little bit cynical about the prospect for empathy to exist in a conversational vacuum, right? It's great to sit in New York and say we should have more empathy for the Donald Trump voter. It's really hard to do that when you don't actually know a Donald Trump voter, when you don't actually live close to a Donald Trump voter. And so I sort of see this political segregation, the really negative trend in our political discourse, as more a symptom than a cause. And what it's a symptom of is that we are an incredibly geographically segregated country, right? So it's not just the coast. It's also some of our, you know, urban cores, Indianapolis, Cincinnati, Columbus, and so forth, where you have people who are doing relatively well economically, who have certain values and attitudes, and who really don't interact a whole lot with people who are that different from them. And that the same thing is true in so-called middle America. You have folks who, you know, maybe they're middle class, maybe they're working class, maybe they're even doing pretty well for themselves, but they really do live in a cultural vacuum. And I really worry that unless we do something to actually get those groups of people to spend more time with each other and not just talk about how they should show more empathy towards one another, we're sort of fighting an uphill battle. I mean, The thing that I think has framed my mindset towards this election is that I know a lot of Trump voters and I know a lot of Hillary Clinton voters. That's, I think, increasingly less true for a large segment of this of our country.
J.D. Vance is the author of the memoir Hillbilly Elegy, and he's the subject of the first 2017 presidential lecture series talk with President Mitch Daniels of Purdue. J.D., thanks for your time.
Thank you.